morning, everyone. Welcome to the very small subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Tuesday, March 25th, and at this time I'm going to open up a public hearing as a subcommittee, and we're going to be taking a look at the agency overview. And at this time we're going to be finishing up with Troy Costales, and we're also going to have Lori Byerly come up and talk about the section of the governor's budget called Department of Transportation, Transportation Safety Division. Tap of the gavel, we'll do that. So it works like a miracle.
Yeah.
I didn't get a little pen. Pardon me, I'm really out of it this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair George, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Lori Byerly from Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. I'm the analyst assigned to the Department of Transportation. In front of you should be a familiar-looking gray packet that says Transportation Safety. On page 2 of the packet, you'll see a brief high-level overview of a comparison for the Transportation Safety Division's budget. You'll see where the division's budget was at 1999-2001, about $18.4 million total funds. You'll see funding sources at that time included both other funds and lottery, other and federal funds, no lottery. And the next column over will show you where the budget was at the end of the 2001 regular session. The department had about $22.5 million in its budget at that time, and the budget did include a portion of general fund, about $200,000 general fund. Actions through the fifth special session and moving on into governor's budget removed that general fund. Some of those dollars, or all those dollars almost, were backfilled with funding from the Department of Transportation's Transportation Operating Fund. These are dollars associated with the highway fund that have been determined to be not really be eligible for direct highway fund programs, so related to gas taxes derived from things like lawnmower use, power tool use, purchases of gas where people pay the tax but don't actually put it in a car and drive on the road. So there's a pocket of money related to that that has been used not only in transportation safety but in some of the other divisions that had general fund to backfill general fund reductions. And you'll see more of that as we move through other divisions today.
Lori, let me ask you a question about that, because in the past when we had our ag exempt, we had a tank that was filled with this kind of gas and a tank filled with that kind of gas, but anymore we just pay the tax and don't even bother with all the paperwork. And I know a lot of people are doing that. Is it just purely an estimate of how much of that is being done? Because we'll run some fairly large engines that are on, running gasoline that the tax has been paid on that never get near a road.
Right. Senator George, members of the subcommittee, I can't remember the bill number, but there was a bill passed in the 2001 regular session that said we're going to estimate these dollars by using a survey. Mm-hmm. So a survey was completed. It's called the Household Use Survey. Went out to, I can't remember the exact number, folks, came back, and it asked them about the non-road types of uses. And based on that information, some estimates have been put together. And if you'd like additional detail on what was in that survey and kind of how that was put into the fund and the dollars removed, we can provide that. I don't have it in a good place.
That'll
right
be
now.
Fine.
I believe the survey will be repeated at some point in time. I think the bill might have said, or there might have been an assumption maybe every 10 years or so that survey would be updated, so we would have more current information in order to be able to shift some of those dollars.
Which strikes some sort of percentage and then moves those dollars over into this new category. Okay, thanks.
If you look over on the far right, then you'll see the change from 2001-03 close of session to the 2003-05 budget. There's an increase of about 5.6%. So the division has not really been harmed by the general fund reductions it did take during the current biennium. On page 4, the governor's budget is a 4.6% increase from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget to the fifth special session. That does include some of those reductions. The budget maximizes the use of other funds to offset general fund reductions, like I just mentioned. It maintains transportation safety programs and grants statewide, and it adds resources to support driver education and safety training efforts. It's a policy package that assists the division with some additional workload in that area. On page 5, you'll see how the division spends its dollars in terms of budget category. The bulk of the money by far is in the special payments category. About 71% of the budget goes out in those special payments. As Troy talked yesterday, some of those dollars do go out to local law enforcement agencies, state police, for some safety activities, as well as other local entities that help the department work on safety-type programs. Page 6.
Before you go ahead, capital outlay, Troy, are you the person that's buying those speed indicators for some of the small communities? Is that coming out of this account?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Troy Costales, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Capital outlay includes two things. Yes, the radar units, LIDAR units that are used by predominantly small law enforcement agencies that can't afford them. We also have responsibility for the Team Oregon motorcycle training program, and we have motorcycles in that group for those people that are taking training for the first time that don't have motorcycles. And we replace those on about a 15-year life cycle, so there's a small amount in there to purchase motorcycles to replace the older motorcycles.
If you'll turn to page 6, please. This is kind of a brief outline of how the 2003-05 governor's budget was developed. We began with the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget of about $22.5 million total funds that I had mentioned earlier, incorporated some actions that had been taken through April 2002, both special session and emergency board actions. The division did not have any emergency board actions in that time frame. However, general fund had been reduced by $20,000 due to special session 2. We also included some base budget adjustments, roll-up of 2003 position actions and compensation changes. Based on some budget direction, there will be some changes made to that number based on pulling out some merits and cost of living increases. If you go to page 7, you'll see essential packages. These are packages that make adjustments to the department's kind of baseline operating level. Package 010 includes adjustments for things like mass transit tax, as well as temporary appointments, overtime, things like that. The Transportation Safety Division is small. Its only major adjustment was $2,000 for mass transit. And that's based on a percentage of actual employee salaries. Package 020 had some program adjustments in it. The department overall operates under a fleet acquisition and replacement plan to manage its motor pool. And so you'll see in the division some adjustments related to the anticipated costs for that. Some divisions decrease, some increase based on how they're paying into that program. Transportation Safety had an increase of about $40,000. We also phased in some costs for safety-related publications in an attempt to kind of streamline and put those publication costs in the area most related to them. Some of the publications were moved into Transportation Safety, and the expenditure limitation came along with those projects. Package 030 incorporates inflation and price list agreements based on standard inflation, as well as detailed adjustments that are part of the Department of Administrative Services price list. This includes dollars that go to DAS for its services, as well as other state entities. If you want more detail on this, it is in your big, huge budget book, if you ever want to delve into it and see exactly how those dollars are parsed out. Package 050 is a fund shift. The Transportation Safety Division has seen a decrease in some of its federal funds. It does have federal or other funds available to offset that decrease, so an adjustment was made to kind of make a swap there between the two funding types. Five positions and about $350,000 were affected by that change. On page 8, policy packages in safety's governor's budget. Package 091 incorporates changes occurring as a result of the fifth special session. This package has a net zero impact because it's a situation where we have decreased some safety program general fund expenditures, but at the same time have offset it with the other funds. So the impact is zero, but there is a general fund decrease inside of that package. About $13,000 general fund affected. Package 092, additional program reductions. This package is also a net zero package. After that first adjustment, what was left in the division's budget was $163,000 in general fund. So in order to try and maximize the use of other funds resources in the department, as well as try to isolate the remaining general fund in the couple of areas it was left in rather than have bits and pieces here and there, we made a shift there, reduced the general fund, and restored it with transportation operating fund dollars. Package 430, rent increase, is a net zero package. The department is making some adjustments in how it budgets its services, supplies, line items for rent. This rent realigns expenditures with the actual rent payout account number or line item. It does that by reducing corresponding amount in some other services and supplies line items. What you would see within that services and supplies category is an adjustment among accounts or line items. And the last package, Package 431, is a program enhancement and reclassification package. $135,000. This package does add one program tech one position and reclassifies a program representative one position up to a program representative two. The department has been working on driver education and other safety initiatives, which have increased its workload as well as increased the level of technical expertise needed to facilitate and operate those programs. I'm done with my spiel. I don't have any questions.
Any questions? Okay, Terry, before you start, let me reopen this full committee.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Troy Stallis, manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And we did start in safety yesterday morning, and so in the presentation packet, the safety area, we'll jump ahead to page 35 in that presentation area and start about halfway through. The safety division does do what's called problem identification before we do the grants and programs, as Ms. Farrelly had pointed out, 71% of our budget is in special payments or grants. We look across the state in the big areas of DUI, speed, safety belt, child safety seats, teen driving, bicycle, pedestrian, et cetera. There's a long list of subject areas we work in. We do problem identification to find out, is it something that needs to be done at state level, or are there communities in the state that are having specific problems that we may do some targeted grants, training, or projects? By doing that, we end up in that process creating performance goals. Every single one of our subject areas that we work with, every single one of the programs that we fund, has a set of objectives and performance measures built in. Every one of our grants has a quarterly report that they must submit on how they're doing on progressing towards their goals. They must also submit reimbursements for payment every quarter, even though most do that monthly. My staff also, based on congressional rule, also do a mid-year evaluation of every one of those projects, not just over the phone and by paper, but they actually go on site to make sure that things are going okay and equipment that was bought is being used for the purpose that we granted the money to them. And then we do an annual report on every one of the projects, and my staff do an annual report on the individual programs and then their subject area. How did we do? Oregon's program 4 years ago was identified by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration as a model program on oversight and performance. And if mimicry is a form of flattery, we've been flattered a lot. There are five states that have over the last few years adopted Oregon's program and performance plan and moved it in for how they run their highway safety programs because of the success and the organization that we've been able to put together in our program. We get lots of calls for help from a lot of other states because we have been able to make a difference. As Ms. Farrelly pointed out on page 36, 57% of our money is federal funds. We are entering into a situation where Congress is reworking the federal transportation reauthorization. We are watching that from a safety point of view very pointedly because Congress bounces between sanctions versus incentives. Sanctions meaning that if a state doesn't have certain laws and programs in place, that they'll penalize you. Or the other side, which is they'll put a bucket of money out there and say states that have these programs or laws get to share in this bucket. During the last 6 years of the federal reauthorization, Oregon was one of six states that received every single incentive dollar available the entire six-year run because of our laws, our programs, and the difference we're making. And our hope, of course, is that we see Congress go towards the incentive portion because the programs we have in place, and it allows us to have the federal money for safety that we can continue the good work that we've been doing the last 5 years. The cornerstone issues that we're dealing with in the future will still continue to be safety belts, child safety seats, alcohol and drugs, speed, and pedestrians. Those are the main areas when we look forward in the future where that makes up a clear 70 to 75% of the fatality and injury picture in our state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed on page 36 the ending fund balance, 9901, of $2.9 million. The estimate for this biennium is 4.1. Those seem to be very, very high fund balances for the size of the of the budget. Is there some explanation of why you wouldn't be putting those into programs for safety?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Morris, yes. The two main areas that that ending fund balance are is the driver education program and the motorcycle safety education program. Right. The high schools and community colleges are teaching driver education right now around the state. On July 1, they will close their books and send us a bill sometime in July or August. We've been collecting the revenue for the last year to pay their bill in August. So we end up with a whole year's worth of driver education funds that we have in the bank, and 60 days later we pay them. So we'll always have 1 year of revenue, which is about $3 million, for driver education sitting there in order to pay their bills.
Not sure that's an answer that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, this program was just transferred to the Transportation Department from the Department of Education, and so 9901 is a partial reflection of that program because it was transferred midway through the biennium, and in 2103, the full program was in the Department of Transportation, and so those balances are obligated to school districts around the state. Department out of it is.
Given those transfers, and I understand the cash flow and the timing issues, what would be the balance that would be remaining?
I think Troy was indicating about $1 million.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Morris, less than $1 million would be the ending fund balance.
Senator Dukes.
A lot of schools are dropping drivers in because they can't afford it. Have you given any thought to giving them the money up front so that instead of reimbursing, you're actually paying while it's being offered?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and Senator Dukes, I'll contradict your statement. We've actually had schools adding driver education. We've had six already since January 1 have asked to start up their program.
Let me say, to the best of my knowledge, there is no school in Clatsop County
correct. That
is teaching drivers in. They've all dropped it, even the community college.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, community colleges are picking up a lot of the area where the high schools are not. Community colleges can, because of being a public school, be part of the reimbursement.
Clatsop, they had it, and now they've dropped it.
And as far as to the question about reimbursing partway through the year, we are putting in place our business model to do that.
I'm actually talking about upfronting it, I mean, much as we would with state school funds.
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Dukes, that would take a statutory change. The reimbursement program is based on the school showing which students took the course, making sure that they were on permit. So that they could take the certificate to DMV as part of their license process. And the school is allowed to charge some tuition, so our funds fill in the gap so that the school is a zero cost. We've not looked at that because it's right now in statute we can't upfront them. It's got to be reimbursement. That's the way the statute's written for the driver education funds.
They could sign their. They generally sign kids up for classes at the end of the school year, so that they could sign their kids up. Therefore, you would know all of the ones who were taking it and whether they had.
Mr. Chairman,
and
Senator Dukes,
not and all of that. It could be done in advance.
Yeah, what we're looking at is for those that July and August that do the class, that they can in September turn in those students at the very beginning of the year, and we can reimburse them within 30 days instead of waiting for 12 months. Still would be reimbursed, but it would be a payment partway through the year instead of at the end of the year. Is that? Agree.
Okay. Well, Troy, I noticed in package 20, the publication part of it, and do we have information that will go out to any school district that would encourage young people, because I think the incentives are still built in for a reduction in insurance rates if you have completed one of these programs. Do we have anything that encourages young people to think about that? I mean, they might come to the school district and actually work it backwards and say, we need to develop a program because it's going to save you money. And we've proven, I think, that the young people who go through the programs are better drivers, at least in those early years.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, there are a couple different publications, and that is actually the area that $50,000 is addressing, is the tuning-up manual that is available to young drivers when they sign up for their permit, which is helps themselves as well as their parent or guardian for the time that they're going to be behind the wheel and doing training. And there is outreach and information to the high schools as well as community colleges about what the license process is as well as what the incentives are, because we have seen a 32% reduction in 16-year-old crashes in the last 3 years since the teen licensing and driver education program were merged together. And Mr. Chairman, just to conclude on the safety division, we know what the primary areas are that we need to look forward to and try and make a difference. In 2002 compared to 2001, Oregon had a 12% reduction in fatalities across the state. We went from 488 down to 432. 12% reduction. That was the largest percentage reduction in the western 14 United States as far as the number of fatalities. And last year was the fourth year in a row where we've had below 500 fatalities. And the last time, as Director Warner pointed out yesterday, the last time we were this low that long was 1959 to 1962. And it's, in my opinion, it's going at these programs and at these initiatives at a community grassroots level, doing the problem identification to identify what the need is, whether it's equipment, training, or someone part-time paid for through a grant in a community to try and make a difference. And so far through yesterday, this year, we are 25% down in fatalities compared to last year. We have 28 fewer fatals so far since January 1 than we did at the same time last year. And part of that success is in relationship to the policy and direction and laws and programs that you all have been involved with and put in place towards safety and giving us the ability to go out and use the funds in order to make a difference, because it has made a difference. And Oregon's program continues looked at as being the top of the heap for the last 4 years running. And sometimes we get into situations we get asked to help others out and we have to say no, because it takes us away from doing our job here in Oregon. But I want to thank you for what you've done in safety and what you're doing as well this session, because Oregonians are alive today and not heading to the hospital due to traffic crashes, to the tune of about 1,000 people a month fewer this last year because of the programs in safety. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll try and answer any further questions from yesterday or today that the committee may have.
Representative Smith had a question.
Thank you, Chair George. Let me begin by apologizing for not being here yesterday. I had constituents that needed assistance with an issue. Are we going to be receiving greater information or more detailed information on the use of funds as it relates to the statewide operations and field operations?
Big book. We had the spreadsheet on the table.
I guess what I'm looking for, Chair George, is an understanding of how we dealt with the Attorney General fees. I see that there was some work done in the policy packages on that, and I'm trying to. I guess I'm just interested in how many hours and at what cost are we billing the Attorney General?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, one of the changes this past biennium has been when we've had personal service contracts that have been let to private firms and it has an Attorney General review, the individual divisions now incur that cost instead of the central part of the department. So we had to do a shift at the last minute to say we'll reduce some other supply area printing or something like that in order to cover the amount for Attorney General. And the Safety Division's Attorney General amount is fairly small, approximately $6,300 that we're anticipating either in contract review or the other, and it's we're experiencing this right now, when sometimes when bills have been put in place and there may be a hearing, we may need the Attorney General's opinion or review of a particular law change to make sure that we're in compliance. So generally, it's the two things that we purchase from Attorney General.
So how many hours were billed and with how many requests?
Chairman, and President Smith, I don't know the hourly billing rate of the Attorney General off the top of my head. I'd have to look that up in the because it's the same all across for all state agencies.
My one comment to the committee is last session during our Ways and Means work in public safety, there is a tremendous amount of discussion over the charging of or use of the Attorney General and the expense that was having. And I think that's something as we go through these very large budgets we need to be keeping our eyes on. Thank you.
Sir, can you do a comparison, say, between the 9901 and the 103 and what we anticipate in this budget?
Mr. Chairman, in 9901, Safety Division spent in Attorney General fees $4,228 and anticipating $6,236 this biennium, which is approximately 39 hours of Attorney General request time.
Thank you, Senator Dukes.
I was going to say, I know the AG's. I remember when they went over $100, so I apparently that was a few years ago because we're up even more than that now. Could you talk about the FTE increases? I'm looking at 9901, we had 18.71 FTE, and now you're up to 25.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, there are two reasons for that. First, Safety Division now has five region coordinators. There's somebody working in each of the region offices within the highway regions that work for me for the Safety Division that are local contacts and have money that they can grant locally, and also are involved in the highway traffic management program to represent the behavioral side of safety when they're looking at projects or scoping projects out. So there's five FTE.
Is that a federal program, or did the federal government send us money and we chose to spend it that way?
Chairman and Senator Dukes, the latter. We've chosen to use some of the federal highway safety dollars so that we have people located around the state. They're involved in, like, the local child safety seat clinics that are involved, or the victim impacts panels, or quite often they're doing presentations to the driver education classes at the local high schools or community colleges.
Local police used to handle those pieces, and now we're doing it. I get nervous when we start hiring people instead of putting money in the ground. And given that all of those programs had people there, not our people, mind you, that had people there who were handling it. I mean, city police have been doing infant seat clinics and bicycle helmet clinics for years. You're going to have to talk fast.
Just Jerry,
I think that's okay.
And Senator Dukes.
I understand ODOT's desire to have a good, strong regional presence in each one of the regions. And we don't always agree on what all we mean by a strong regional presence in each one of them. I think you got a few extra folk out there you probably don't need. Not that they're not doing good work, but when it comes to putting money into projects.
All five of these individuals in the region are program level. I mean, for the most part, they are active in getting involved in the projects, visiting with the local traffic safety committees, with city council or county commissions when there's an issue about what should the signing be around the school zone on a city street. And the citizen isn't able to get the city or somebody to respond about what's correct or not, or stop sign versus a signal, or there's been some issues about drinking and driving in the area. That my staff person gets involved in a lot of those. In a lot of cases, law enforcement isn't doing the child safety clinics at the pace they used to be, yet there is that need at the local level. And so three of the five people that work for me are certified technicians to be able to help with those community events when they're asked.
Is that need on the local level based on what? What tells you there is that need at the local level?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, there are 50-plus local traffic safety committees around the state.
I was going to ask you about those, too, because my part of the state's losing them, not gaining them. So,
And
how many cities are there? Here we go.
100
some cities?
No, 232.
So roughly a quarter of them have traffic safety committees?
Correct. And Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, also we work with the neighborhood associations or the local school advisory committee, PTA groups.
That's not your district in mind. Okay. Just checking.
And they also work with interest groups that pop up like there was an interest group around the 1822 corridor that was interested in what was going on there, and so the Region 2 person worked with them to provide the information about what's going on with that safety corridor, or to respond to citizen requests for crash data or law enforcement data, or access to some of the information, like if high school wanted to get involved in driver ed, what do they need to do, how do they get that access.
Just to find
very
a bunch
busy.
Of good things, but mostly they're good things in big cities. And the decision was made by somebody, whether it was the commission, I don't, or the director, I don't know, to put one of these in each of the regions, one FTE. And my district didn't have many traffic safety committees left. For lack of use, most of them have gone by the wayside. At least that's the complaint that the members give when they resign from the committees and ask the mayor not to appoint a new one, or the county commission. And we don't have any safety corridors that I can think of, unless maybe 26 is one now because we can't afford to repair it. Most of those things are things that are not necessarily needed once you get out of the I-5 corridor. It would be nice. I'd love it if we were on the level where we had all that stuff going on and all those needs. So what I'm questioning is not so much you, it's a bigger question, as do we ever stop and say, do we need them all over the state, or do we just want them all over the state? And you didn't get to make that decision. I understand that. But, this is five people. This is, I'm sure they're finding stuff to keep them busy. These are five people, some of them doing things that local government used to do. We're paying a salary and roll up for each one of them. And that's money that's not going into providing helmets for kids or carriers for infants or any of those kinds of things.
And, Mr. Chairman, the other add for the FTE was, as Mr. Jordan pointed out, the shift of the driver education program from Department of Education to the Safety Division in March of 2000. And so there was the FTE associated with that program was added and approved by the e-board during the 9901 session. And right now we're running that program with 1.5 FTE for statewide program with 130 providers around the state, with nearly 900 instructors that are teaching driver education.
No. If it's not in my county, I don't figure it's a statewide program. Sorry.
Well, Troy, there is all of us, I think, share a little sensitivity to the fact that we've reached into local government budgets and took off some of the money. Mm-hmm. And so my question is more or less a philosophical question, but I sure would like an answer on it, and that is, would the department consider the idea of, the cost of 5 FTE and an office and a computer and cars and everything else is a fairly substantial amount of money, about doing the transfers back to the local jurisdiction, let them continue their local operations in the school, because that's always been the tradition of this. ICS is supplying the information, giving the direction and enabling them to carry it out, rather than us putting another layer on top of that. And so,
Mr. Chairman, quite often the staff here in Salem, as well as the five region staff, are working in conjunction or in addition to what's provided by the locals. If there is no individual area in the area that's going to be able to do that safety seat clinic or to do part of the driver education program, that's when the regional person will step in. If there's nobody there to help the neighborhood association figure out how to apply for a $5,000 mini grant in order to get training for their officers, or to get the LIDAR unit, or to get the radar reader trailer that they can put in the communities, the region person is the one that's helping them figure out where to go get that, whether that's from ODOT, whether that's from AAA or MAD or other places. They become that information person and that conduit in order to get equipment and training and money back into the local community. And for the safety division, we have a requirement that from Congress that at least 40% of our funds go to local entities. And in Oregon, we far and exceed that. In the special payments area between city, counties, and other government units, which is the Police Association and the Chiefs Association, there's about $6.5 million per biennium that we're going out to counties and cities all over the state.
Troy, do this for me. If you'd give me the total cost of all of the FTE and the cost of all of the office space, all of the costs related to moving those into each one of the regions, because there's going to be a cost associated with them being situated in any given spot, I'd like to see that. And I'm going to make a contact with the cities and counties and ask them if they wouldn't mind taking a look at this, too. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. In your facilities rent, I'm assuming those facilities are that space rented within the larger part of the department?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, no. The safety division is renting a facility from a private property owner here in Salem.
Can you share with me what the square footage cost on that is?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, all-encompassing square footage cost is $1.10 per square foot. That includes the property, the landscape, the custodial, the electrical, the gas, the water, the taxes, janitorial, refurbish of paint and carpet at the six-year intervals, and it's extremely low for in the Salem area.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, further questions from the viewers?
All right, I guess more of a statement. I don't mean to be beating up Troy. He does a good job. He really does. And this division has improved vastly since he took it over. Where I have the difficulty is an internal thing within ODOT, and it changes from time to time. And sometimes I think I've been here too long because I think I've seen two complete circles on this one where we... Sometimes in ODOT, we believe that we should have the resources out in the regions, and sometimes we believe we should have them internally in Salem within or Portland within the district that, or the agency. And sometimes we think, well, if we have them here, then we can train them up right, and we can send them out to where they're needed. And so they're centrally located. And sometimes we think if we have them out in the regions, then they're out there where the people are actually experiencing the problems. They understand the community better, and they can respond better. And as I said, I think we've done, every so many years you'll see a budget with a new director that decides to haul them all back into Salem. And then we spit them all back out a few years later. And at the moment, we've got them all out in the region. But the biggest difficulty I have with it is that they're cookie cutters, pretty much. We have one of these. I remember when we got, forget which position it was out there, and we got one because we didn't have one and all the other regions did, so therefore we needed to have one too. And I'm not sure that it's been a particularly good addition to our region, but we have one. And so I think sometimes we need to look at the different regions of the state and say that transportation-wise, especially when you get off the highways and into other things like transportation safety, they're not all the same, and that if you're not offering any driver's ed and there's nobody, apparently many of your folks are out there trying to help us get any, and if we have local governments that are capable of doing some of these things, that therefore maybe you need one in Medford, but maybe you don't need one in Astoria. So that's my biggest thing, is I don't doubt that the theory is good. I just think that in practice, sometimes we're spending money we don't need to be spending.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of a comment as we're coming down. Certainly looking at the decreases in deaths and stuff, I kind of like to go by numbers. And my assumption is you're doing an incredibly good job in terms of the total mosaic of all the different pieces that fit together. I'm not really in a position to judge, and I don't really want to, whether they're all fitting perfectly or not, but I think the end result is very, very good. Also, the fact that it's a totally other funded agency in this environment just tickles me to no end. The one suggestion that I would hope as we go through before we go into work session would be looking at this concept that we talked about yesterday in terms of the overtime grants for police agencies, if there's a way to get that, and that's probably going to be involving the police agencies having to change their internal controls to get that at state at straight time rather than overtime. The other the other hope would be, as we go through the readjustment of attorney general charges and figure in the wage freezes and these things, since that's going to free up some money, but it's got strings attached to it that it, you know, it just can't go to the general fund. It has to be spent on your programs. To be able to increase that support for policing agencies and working on the safety issues that are legitimate for us to spend money on, I guess for want of a better term, I'll use wage freeze dividend. If that wage freeze dividend could be spent on increasing our police presence, that coupled with straight time, I think could actually make an impact in terms of a few more troopers on the road or some more support for local government policing that in this environment is going to be real important. So if we could look at that before we get to work session, Mr. Chair, I would certainly appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, the one thing I do in working with this agency is I look at the budget as basically being a water balloon with a collar. On the one side, there are the costs relating to providing the programs and the printing and the material as we're directed by statute. Seems every session we've got some other program we've got to talk about. And what isn't in that side of the collar is on the other side, and that's the grants and the programs. And I've set a goal that we maintain an 80% towards program, 20% towards delivery split, and we've exceeded it now for the third biennium to where we're at about 84% program and only 16% program delivery. And so that means, you know, for every dollar that we get, 84 cents is going to a grant, to a program, versus providing the statewide information or programs as directed by statute.
Representative Hanson. The Smiths, too.
Thank you, Chair George. Let me compliment you first on only $47 for dues and subscriptions. I believe when you watch your pennies, the dollars follow. I have a question, I guess a little transportation 101. Explain to me why the capital outlay for automotive and aircraft of $39,118. Can you tell me what that's for?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Smith, we operate the Team Oregon Motorcycle Safety Program, which is a program offered anybody under the age of 21 that would like a motorcycle endorsement or a license must take this program, and yet others take it as well. It helps. You get a free pass at DMV by taking the program, and we have a fleet of motorcycles because there are those people that come in that are on permit or don't own motorcycles. They're on about a 15-year replacement cycle. And so there's a set of them that we're expecting to replace next biennium.
Thank you. Okay.
Any further questions or comments for Troy? You're out of here.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to, we have the answers that were prepared for us, some of the questions from yesterday, but I'm going to wait and hopefully Senator Carter will get here and then we'll review those. So at this time, I'm going to ask Lori Byerly to go ahead and move into the public transit division. And Martin, if you'd like to come on up, that would be terrific.
Chair George, members of the subcommittee, once again, I'm Lori Byerly from DAS Budget Management. In front of you, there should be another packet called Public Transit, the same lovely gray shade. I will proceed to give you a brief overview of what's in the governor's budget for 2003-05 for the public transit division. Take a look on page 2 of your packet. You can see where the division was back in 1901. Actual expenditures for that biennium were about $24 million. There was about $9 million in general fund at that time, and the remaining sources come from other and federal funds. If you take a look from there to 2003-05 governor's budget, you'll see that general fund number has decreased by about $2 million. This is primarily due to the reductions that were taken during the 2001-03 biennium. Much like in transportation safety, almost all of those funds have been backfilled with other fund sources from within the department. Governor's budget for 2003-05 is at $45 million. 14 positions. That's an increase of about just under 2% from where the agency was during the course of the 2001-03 biennium. You want to turn to page 3. You can see how the division spends its dollars by fund type. Over half of the money coming into the division and being spent is from federal fund sources, about 15% in general fund, and 25% other funds. On page 4, like I said earlier, the budget is an 1.8% increase from the 2001-03 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The budget does use other funds' resources to offset some general fund reductions. It supports public transit programs and grants, and it adds some resources to help the division manage its financial resources. Some of those reductions that were taken during 2001-03 included reductions in estate grants of Lane Transit District, some dollars that were intended to go out on for transportation cooperation projects around the state, some dollars that were intended to work on focusing resource allocation decisions among the needs of Oregon's elderly and disabled for transportation, and another contract that was going to work with the coordination of pupil and public transportation. In addition, there were some reductions made in other grant programs that were restored to a certain extent with other funds from the Transportation Operating Fund. If you'd like to go take a look at page 5, you'll see how the division spends its money by category. And you'll see that, by far, the largest portion of dollars in this division is going out of the department to other entities, local government, transportation providers across the state. Small portion of the division's budget is for personal services at 4%. That would be that 14 FTE or positions that I mentioned previously, and 2% for services and supplies. On page 6, to begin building the 2003-05 governor's budget for the division, we took where the division was back in 2001-03, was at $45.9 million total funds, incorporated some of those changes that occurred during the course of the 2001-03 biennium, which included some of those general fund reductions, added in some base budget adjustments for compensation and position actions. Like I said earlier, there were some adjustments to those based on the wage-free subsidy that Representative Hansen mentioned earlier. Page 7, essential packages. Package 010 includes about $4,000 in adjustments for temporaries, overtime, and mass transit taxes. Package 020 is where we phase expenditures in and out of the budget based on anticipated needs, typically ongoing programs. Within ODOT, this is typically highway construction projects as well as dollars for some of their fleet management operations within the division, about $15,000 for fleet acquisition adjustments. Yesterday I mentioned the department had, since governor's balanced budget, been looking at some additional changes it'd like to make to the budget in order to make things work better. There is a technical adjustment requested in this package that would align some of the central. The department operates kind of a central services assessment where the divisions pay into the central services based on an assessment process to receive things back that the central area provides. Central services will be one of the last operational divisions we look at. And adjustments need to be made to match this division's actual anticipated costs up with those expenditures in the budget. So this adjustment would make a change of about $80,000 to the department's interagency assessment. Package 030 includes inflation and price list adjustments for inflation and state government service charges, about $300,000, a little bit over. When Representative Smith was talking earlier about the AG, I went back and looked, and it is currently in the governor's balanced budget at billing AG costs at $109 per hour, and I believe it's part of that Department of Justice review in Ways and Means, or could very likely be a drop in that figure, but governor's balanced budget is based on $109 per hour for AG costs. Going on to page 8, policy packages for public transit for 2003-05. The first three packages relate to general fund reductions taken during the 01-03 biennium that were rolled forward. Package 082, fifth special session adjustments. You'll see that all three packages are net zero packages. It means we had reduced general fund, increased the other funds to offset those reductions in all three situations. Package 082 shifts $300,000 in general fund. Package 091 shifts $603,000 in the general fund to other funds. and package 092 shifts another $750,000 in general fund to other funds. Package 187, public transit is participating in an internal pilot within the agency to adjust how they handle the maintenance and ongoing costs of the Mill Creek building that the department is, has some of its programs housed in. This package changes, sets kind of a rental program where this program is actually going to pay a rent expenditure into the agency as opposed to paying different S&S line items to take care of various issues in the building. The idea is to be able to coordinate, centralize, and better operate that building's expenditure and maintenance costs. You'll see this package in some other division budgets to move along. This is a net zero package because, like I said, adjustments were made in other S&S line items to, in order to bring that rent line item to the appropriate level, about $57,000. Package 410, Public Transit Fiscal Manager. This is a net zero package that is funded by a decrease in special payments in order to cover the costs of one position for dedicated budgeting and financial management. Several of the divisions in the department do have a resource dedicated to helping with budgeting specifically and other financial activities. The transit division does not have one. This would provide that division the resource to provide ongoing budget and financial management services and assist in responding to things like questions from the legislature. That's my speech. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lori, the discrepancy between what is on page 55 of the three-ring binder, which lists the 0103 estimate of the budget at $35.2 million, and close it. Session at 45.9, close the fifth special session at 44.7. What would be the reason for that?
Chair George Timmermans, can you tell me what page you're referring to again?
Page
and is it in the program?
55 in this morning's book.
Senator Morse, Chair George, you're looking at the difference between the 2001-03 estimate and the 2003-05 governor's budget, or the first two columns?
Well, you have total available revenue of $38 million, total uses $35 million in the 0103. I'm trying to figure out why that's different than what you have presented in the 0103 in terms of total funds.
Chair George, Senator Morris, the way that budget and management develops the budget, which is what I've shown you, does not incorporate every single action that's taken place since April 2002. The department or the division did receive some limitation since April 2002 that's built into those estimates, but it's not reflected in the figures I gave you. We use the April 2002 as kind of our starting point to begin budget development. If you were to look at the figures that Ms. Jordan provided you on the division within her display, you would see the to-date figures. It's through January, I believe. The to-date figures for what the divisions actually received through the course of the 2103 biennium. So it did receive some additional limitation later in the biennium. It's not reflected in those numbers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, also the estimates are based on what the agency estimated their expenditures would be in April of 2003, and Lori's numbers are a little bit different because she's basing it on the budget versus what was taken away from the expenditure limitation. So actual expenditures are likely to be different than the budgeted numbers because they're not based on what the agency's expecting to actually spend in the biennium, and that's what the estimates are. And if they went back and looked at their estimates today, they might be a little bit different because they have more information since April to base that number on. So these numbers aren't the most current information that the agency could give you. Does that help?
No, it does not help. Maybe I could ask the question. The data that on which this was based was as of what time period versus when this was?
Okay. The basis for estimated information is based on their actual expenditures through April of 2002. And they look at from what they've actually spent, and they look ahead, and they determine what they think they're going to spend by the end of the biennium, and they come up with these numbers of what they're actually going to spend. The numbers that you see in the budget aren't based on actual expenditures. They're based on where you start at close of session with a budgeted number, which is an estimate of what they think they're going to spend in the next, in the whole biennium. And as you move through the biennium, we had several special sessions and we reduced certain aspects of their budget, but we didn't go in and look at all their other funded programs and do any reductions in those expenditure limitations that the agency could spend. And so there's going to be a difference between what's actually budgeted and what they think they're going to spend.
At the end of session 2001, there was an estimate that there would be approximately $45.6 million expended. In April of 2002, the department apparently is estimating $35.2 million. Why the discrepancy?
Because we budgeted more than they're actually going to spend. We said you can spend up to $45.8 million. We're not requiring them to spend up to that amount, but we said you can. But they're saying we're not going to.
Then the question is
maybe
why.
It will become more clear as we go along. But
take a stab at it.
Let's go to Senator Dukes. Okay. Maybe she has an answer. We'll come back.
Why don't we try 9901?
Mm-hmm.
There were no special sessions in there, and we have the final numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I guess we get all the way to the bottom. Okay, they actually balance. It seems to me that I know we did reductions to ORDOT during at least some of those five special sessions.
In the general fund area, yes. But we replaced the general fund with other funds. And so there's, in some areas...
Did we always?
Not at the very beginning, but towards the middle of the session. I mean, the later special sessions, we did go back and replace it with those other funds from the transportation operating. But that's not going to answer Senator Morris's question about why there is a difference. It's just that they're not going to spend and maybe Martin can explain why.
Can ask Martin if it,
why they're not going to spend all their limitations. Yeah.
Chair George, committee members. My name is Martin Loring. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division within the Oregon Department of Transportation. Maybe the easiest and most responsive thing to do in answer to Senator Morse's question is to develop a worksheet with the latest information and assumptions about what we think we're going to expand with all the adjustments. We went to the emergency board, got some more limitation. There were some cuts and shifts. We can certainly lay that out on paper and all agree on one set of numbers that accurately reflect our best thinking in this area.
Excuse me. I guess I'm not interested in trying to get something that's, you know, just totally correct for a period that's still yet to be completed, because you'll have to make those estimates. What I'm interested in is why there's such a huge discrepancy between your estimate of $35.2 million and LFO's at $44.7 million.
Chair George, Senator Morris, I think we can all admit that state budgeting is a challenge. In terms of the budget that I'm responsible for, knowing how much we're going to spend is pretty easy. But most of the money, as was mentioned by Ms. Barley, goes out in grant agreements. Knowing when it will go out drives me nuts. If some jurisdictions buying three buses, it may take 10 months for those buses to build. It's an obligation, but we don't pay that money out until the vehicles have been received and accepted. So we essentially budget based on the limitation and revenues we expect to receive, and then try to manage them so that these investments, improvements in transportation services occur as quickly as we can get them to. But my ability to precisely estimate when that will be is not very good. Certainly not as good as I would like it to be. And I believe that that accounts for most of the difference in estimation.
It places a credibility factor here that concerns me, the relationship between these numbers. And you're projecting revenues of 38.1, and through the fifth special session, projecting revenues of 44.7. And that's a huge difference. And it gives me concern.
Sure, George, Senator Morrison, this probably isn't terribly helpful, but we've got a couple, three different things going on here. We have a revenue picture, we have a budget picture, and we've got an expenditure picture, which sometimes meet, but they don't always tie out quickly in terms of timing. So the revenues out there, I mean, there could be some fluctuations based on beginning balances or ending balances that drive that picture. We address the budget side through expenditure limitation, what the agency needs at different times in the biennium. And at the same time, they're paying out on some of these contracts where it's not real clear what they think they're going to pay out at a certain time. And I'm trying to think of what we could provide you that would help. I understand your concern about, you know, what's the real number, and if we're not able to find it, how do we budget and provide limitation and trust that what we're giving the agency is what's going to work for them? And I don't have a good answer other than we need to continue to communicate through this process as well as during the interim with the emergency board process. And that e-board process is in place to help alleviate situations where limitation is inadequate. On the flip side, the emergency board cannot reduce limitation if it's over adequate. So sometimes budgets may, through some sort of process, end up being a little higher in terms of limitation simply because there's no mechanism to drive that back down. Through the Department of Administrative Services, what we can do is what's called unscheduling limitation, which means essentially we know that there's too much limitation in the department, and we say we're going to freeze a portion of that so you can't spend it because we know you have too much. But there's no budgetary way to pull that back down unless you're actually in session.
Well, let me ask this question. We're going to face several rooms full of folks that are coming in on senior and disabled transportation. And if they were to look at those numbers, would they say, is there any flexibility here?
Chair George, I'm not sure I understand the question. Flexibility, we believe that we have obligated all of the resources you've appropriated for us to use. So, and I don't believe that the differences in the estimates generate the ability to approve any additional grants that we haven't already approved. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Ms. Byerly mentioned one of our POPs. Boy, do I need someone to help me with these budget numbers.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, one of the differences is a $3.3 million emergency board request in November of 2002 that allowed the agency to pay for grants that were moving faster than they had anticipated. So they moved some money forward that they had not an expenditure limitation for. That you didn't take into account in your estimate. You had the...
Senator George, committee members, Ms. Jordan said is true. In thinking of contingencies that affect this, not only was that a recent change, the legislature also passed Senate Bill 862, which embargoed an estimated $1.8 million of the additional $3 million we got authority to spend.
Right.
So we are... as my bicycle friends say, we are pedaling as fast as we can to try to competently manage these. I mean, what I hear in Senator Morse's question is a concern about stewardship. This is a concern that we share deeply and take our responsibility to ably manage public resources and trust our care very seriously. we can account for the discrepancies, and we will, but I don't have the answers to satisfy the senator at my fingertips.
Well, in addition to that, where we've taken away the revenue, we didn't take away the expenditure limitation at the same time during that special session. So they're not going to receive as much revenue because we shifted the special transportation dollars of tobacco tax money over to another program area. And so they're not going to reach their expenditure limitation as a result of that as well. So there are explanations for that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. I hope it's okay, Senator Morris. I moved to a different senator.
Yes, I'm.
Okay. Didn't want to.
Don't sense there's an answer.
Yeah. Well, we can come back.
Okay. Thank you, Chair George. On page 39, the very first sentence, even though we don't own or operate vehicles, the division is in the mobility business. The question I have is, does the public transit division then finance vehicles and turn around and lease them or rent them out to the communities?
Chair George, Representative Smith, the short answer is no. The state neither owns nor operates buses or vans used to transport the general public or special needs publics. We're more like the bank, only instead of loaning the money to local governments and private not-for-profit corporations, we write grant agreements. We provide a certain amount of state and federal grant assistance, which they match with local resources to purchase the vehicles and operate them.
Follow up?
Certainly.
Where does the local money traditionally come from to service the debt on these vehicles?
Chair George, Representative Smith, there is no debt on these vehicles. These are grants. And the local resources used to match these grants, and matching rates are all over the board. For operations grants, the match might be at a 50-50 rate. For some vehicle purchases, it might be 20% local, 80% state or federal funds. Other grants, 10.27. The local funds comes from across the gamut. Local taxes, property tax in some cases, other dedicated local taxes. In some cases, it's the proverbial bake sales that a senior center might have. It could be donations. It could be, it often is fare box revenue. You know, a combination of local resources that these not-for-profits and local governments scrape together with some great difficulty, I might add.
So the follow-up, Chair. So the local community then owns the vehicle?
Chair George, Representative Smith, yes.
Follow-up then really quick. How come the public transit division cares about the condition of the vehicle? I'm now on page 48 where it talks about vehicle condition. And it talks about how the division's goal is to help maintain these vehicles.
Chair George, Representative Smith, we care about the condition of vehicles because the better they are maintained, the less we'll have to invest to replace them. And the better they're maintained, the better condition they're in, the safer the occupants of those vehicles are. We don't want to finance vehicles that are used in a way that would make that use unsafe to the people that need those rides and depend on them.
I just want to make sure I understand this. So then vehicles that need special maintenance, are there grant dollars to the communities to provide that special maintenance?
Chair George, Representative Smith, on occasion we have, in fact, made special grants available. There's a very small pot of money in the budget. I forget what it's labeled, but it amounts to about $75,000. That essentially are recoveries of the state matching share from vehicles that have been disposed of at the end of their useful life. We have made special grants from this source upon occasion to replace a transmission. I can think of a case where in Klamath Falls, Basin Transit Service was getting rid of a couple of ramp-equipped minivans. And there was a not-for-profit that wanted those vehicles, but I talked to the general manager of that transit agency. They were in pretty good condition, but the transmissions was shot on one and close to it on the other. We arranged some special financing to get those vehicles repaired cost-effectively in the basic transit shop, and transferred the titles to the not-for-profit corporation that needed them.
I just want to make sure I understand. On that page 48, then, where it says 80% or more of the fleet of vehicles which we finance to meet, so could that word be changed grant money to?
No.
Okay. When I think of finance, I think of debt service.
Yes, I have this problem with putting prepositions at the end of sentences. But other than that, the sentence is
so which we grant money to meet.
Yeah.
It's clear. Thank you.
Martin, maybe we better let you walk through your program and then and we'll either bring up questions or answer questions. And Lori, you're completed.
I think I was finished.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair George. Thank you, Chair George. I believe I had completed my presentation.
Martin, we'll start moving through it.
Thank you, Chair George. Representative Smith was referring to the 2003-2005 Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development presentation document, which you all have in front of you. That does start, our portion of that document starts on page 39. My remarks will refer to various pages in that presentation document, some of which we've already visited, as I try to clearly answer the four questions posed by the Ways and Means Committee co-chairs, Representative Miller and Senator Schrader. These questions are why the Public Transit Division exists, how the division has been performing, how the division uses its budget, and what can be expected in terms of outcomes from its budget request. If my job is done right, these questions should be answered as I acquaint you with who we are, what we do, and why we do it. Why does the Public Transit Division exist? A public transit division or section has existed for some 25 years, long before my time. We exist to serve ODOT's mission. As Director Warner told you yesterday, our mission is to provide a safe, efficient transportation system supporting economic opportunity and livable communities for all Oregonians. Public Transit Division contributes by working with others to provide mobility for people who need it. As Representative Smith points out, we don't own vehicles, we don't operate them, but we provide grant financing or grants for people to purchase or operate the vehicles that provides the needed service. Mobility is a key means to achieving independence, productivity, and quality of life ends. Mobility supports connections with family, friends, communities of faith, and many of the other things determining quality of life. Our staff and other resources are organized around the type of funds managed, that is, state or federal, and the type of transportation need that the grant funds were legislatively authorized to address. Excuse me. How has the division been performing? This question will be answered as I discuss each of the five types of products or services that the division delivers. How does the division use its budget? When this presentation is done, I fervently hope that you feel the answer as well. As was mentioned earlier, a staffing level of 14 and $45.6 million in expenditure limitation is requested in the 2003-2005 budget. This investment would continue the level of public transportation assistance and programs that the division is currently providing. An organization chart is provided on page 45 of the presentation document. As you can see, the division is a flat organization with all staff reporting directly to the division administrator. We've already found the high-level summary of the division's budget numbers on page 55. It organizes revenues by fund type, state general fund, state other funds, and federal funds. Expenditures are organized by the product or service we deliver. Perhaps the most important fact about this budget is that 94% of the requested expenditure authority is for special payments. Special payments are state and federal funds that aren't spent by the state, per se, but rather are sent as grant payments to be spent by local governments, private not-for-profit corporations, and for-profit business enterprises delivering transportation services to the people who need them. I think that bears repeat. $9.40 of each $10 in the budget is passed through, goes out the door to local governments and their partners that actually deliver the transportation services. Now, the other standard budget expenditure categories, personal services for the 14 staff, account for 4.4% of the budget, while services and supplies take the last 1.7%. No capital outlay is requested in this budget. Let's take a look at the products or services we deliver briefly. The first is special needs transportation services. This is capital and operating grant assistance for transportation services benefiting Oregon's elderly and disabled representatives. This program area takes just over 70% of our budget and about 4.2 FTE. The next service area is general public transportation. This is capital and operating assistance for transporting the general public in small communities, communities of fewer than 50,000 people, and rural areas. This is just under 25% of the budget and some 6.8 FTE. Transportation demand management coordinates efforts to promote voluntary alternatives to driving alone during peak hours. This program area is 0.4 tenths of 1% of the budget and 1 FTE.
Martin, did you end up with the smart jitney thing over? Are you supposed to be working on developing that?
No, not.
Chair George, no.
No. Are we going to find that anywhere? Or?
Chair George, not in this budget, and I don't know about
it actually was in
broader.
The Department of Education budget.
Well, I know, but my understanding was that there was a parallel. I was told there was a parallel operation going on to develop that technology within ODOT. I didn't see enough money to do it, but
Chair George, there was a program option package that we presented that ended up on the cutting room floor, as it were, for a transit trip planner project. We didn't do our job well enough in developing that package in terms of securing the federal funds from our partners that would be needed to implement it, and it was suggested that without that federal commitment, the package should not be in there, and if we get permission to apply for federal grant funds at an e-board and are lucky enough to get them, we will be back visiting with the legislature about those sorts of applications of technology to planning trips.
I was told that TriMet is already moving forward with something that's probably an early stage of that concept.
Chair George, TriMet currently implements a trip planner, an itinerary builder, where you can enter your current location and where you want to get, express some preferences as to, you know, walking no more than half a block, or I like trains, I don't like buses, or I like buses, don't like trains, and quickest trip, cheapest trip, et cetera. And it will give you explicit instructions. You know, turn left, walk half a block, get on this numbered bus, which will arrive at this time. You know, explain the transfers and get you there. It's quite an exciting system that they have developed, lamentably without our help.
Okay.
Intercity passenger service. We have 2.1% of the budget and 1 FTE working to ensure that people living in communities of 2,500 or more have access to same-day round-trip transportation to the next largest market economy. And the last of the five program areas is transportation planning. The activities, that's 1 FTE and 2.2% of the budget. Largely involved in administration of grants for multimodal planning needed to qualify the state and six urban areas for tens of millions of dollars in federal transportation funding. If I might digress for just a second, the department is preparing a written answer to the question that Chair George posed yesterday about transit funding, but I do have the Reader's Digest version. Federal transit funding was the budget for the Federal Transit Administration for federal fiscal year 2003 was approved just weeks ago as part of the omnibus budget bill, and that the overall budget bill for the Federal Transit Administration was just under $7.3 billion for that one fiscal year. I'm not talking biennial numbers. I'm talking about one federal fiscal year for the period of time starting last October running through 30 September 2003. Of that $7.3 billion, $126.5 million in grant funds are committed to various recipients in the state of Oregon. Of that $126.5 million, $118 million will go directly to Oregon jurisdictions of one type or another without going through ODOT's budget or any ODOT involvement whatsoever. Of the remaining $2.5 million will go to three small urban communities from 50 to 200,000 population, Corvallis, Bend, Medford. Technically, the governor is the recipient of those funds, but they don't go through the state budget, and our level of control or influence over those funds is minimal at most. The final, just under $6 million of the $126.5 million, consist of federal transit administration grants that go through ODOT's budget. And the planning is needed to facilitate all of those. The fourth question is, what can be expected in terms of outcomes from the requested budgetary investment? In the special needs transportation area, we relate to two of Oregon's benchmarks. Number 58 is elderly being able to live alone and independently, and number 59 relates to disabled Oregonians who are able to work, being able to get to and from work. One major outcome that we hope to get out of the Oregon 5 biennium is to sustain the annual level of rides and rides per capita that we're currently delivering to the elderly and disabled Oregonians. We're delivering about 5.5 million rides in '02. We hope to hold that level, and that the rides per capita will be between 6 and 7. Another outcome we plan from this budget is to increase the fleet of vehicles serving the elderly and disabled that we have financed through grants to some 750 vehicles that would be at 80% fare or better condition. And lastly, we want to meet our customer service goal for timely processing of grant payments. In the area of general public transportation services, we propose to sustain our increase in the number of small communities with general public bus service. Excuse me. From 1999 to today, we've been able to increase that number from 29 to 40 communities. And we also have the same customer service goal for timely processing of payment requests. The transportation demand area relates to a benchmark for percent of drive-alone trips during peak travel periods in urban areas, and we have the same customer service goal. Intercity passenger, we propose to increase the number of communities of 2,500 or more in Oregon that meet the Oregon Transportation Commission's intercity policy goal to 95% by 2005. And we have the same customer service goal. And in terms of transportation planning, we would continue to make the six urban areas eligible for Federal Transit Administration Urbanized Area Formula grants and have the same customer service goal. I'd like to go into... I'm sorry, sir.
Martin, what does it look like for the future of the privates? I mean, we're, for example, Greyhound. What are you hearing about their direction? Are they going to increase service or decrease service?
Chair George, the shortest, most accurate answer is I don't know. Greyhound... has had trouble. They're owned by Laidlaw, which is in Chapter 11. We work closely with them. They have not bid on some of our most recent intercity grant solicitations. We are trying to work in a consortium. Greyhound runs service from the Mexican border to the Canadian border four times a day. And we're working with our counterparts in California and Washington to try to make sure that all that service is accessible and that we can try to increase service to other Oregon communities, but don't know how much additional service Greyhound will provide in the near term. But we're working with other privates. There's lots of private providers of transportation service in Oregon, and we're working with most of them.
Thank you, Chair George. When you're financing the community's ability to purchase these vehicles, do the communities purchase them or does the state purchase the vehicles?
Chair George, Representative Smith, the communities purchase the vehicles, but often they purchase them through the state bid. The Department of Administrative Services works with our staff to write specifications for certain vehicles, and they are allowed, as a word of term of art, piggyback. They're allowed to piggyback on those, or sometimes smaller jurisdictions piggyback on specifications written by larger jurisdictions.
So they're able to take advantage of the best available price.
Yes, that's certainly the intent.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to do a follow-up on that question, and that is this. I'm serving right now on a local transit district transit enhancement for Yamhill County, and one of the things we noticed is that a lot of folks will complain about there's no shelter, therefore I'm not standing in the rain to ride your bus. And so, you know, it obviously becomes a major issue. What do you do about getting a shelter for the folks? And one of the things we found out, there's a tremendous variation within the price of those things and what several companies are saying it costs to install them. Have we done anything to try to come up with a bid process that might make those things more affordable? Because we had ranges from about $2,700 to $7,000 or $8,000. And, of course, some of it is the size, but what I'm talking about is a similar size. Is there any view into that about seeing if we could more efficiently buy those units?
Chair George, good question. I have not received any requests to hold a central procurement for shelters per se, but by sharing information among the communities that are buying them, the smart buyer, the informed buyer, can drive the cost down. We do finance quite a few of those shelters. Regrettably, one of the costs we run into when we use federal funds is the delay in the cost of environmental compliance. Believe it or not, we have to map and describe why this 8x10 postage stamp of concrete. Isn't going to affect threatened and endangered species.
It might be residing in the concrete. I was shocked when I.
No, this would be runoff to a stream, Chair George. But it's just as silly. It has resulted in a lot of delays. I don't know if Senator Morse got to share any of the experiences that Bernadette Barrett ran into in building the multimodal center that was just dedicated in Corvallis. But boy, they put her through her paces. The project was delayed endlessly by requirements that kept shifting as if they were in sand and were very difficult and expensive for the city of Corvallis to meet. So this is a constant battle and one of the sources of delay.
Senator Dukes?
When a district or entity is finished with the buses, or vans, or whatever the heck they are, I know that you sometimes transfer them. There used to be, in the contract that gave them the money, the caveat that when they were done with them, then they transferred back to the sort of this statewide system. What happens, I mean, say they just went under. Can things become...
Chair George, Senator Dukes, that's a very good question. As you learned earlier in our discussion with Representative Smith, we don't own the vehicles. But like a bank, we take a security interest in them to protect the state's investment. So although it's a grant, there's no repayment. When DMV titles that vehicle, the state of Oregon is shown as the first lien holder. And the governing body, if it goes through state funds, is shown as the second lien holder, even though the vehicle might be used by a senior center. So if before they may legally dispose of that vehicle, they've got to get the title cleared by us. So we have that hook. Fortunately, I've had no experience with a provider going bankrupt, although we've come perilously close. So we don't have a lot of experience there. We would, in fact, recover those vehicles and redeploy them. And in this area, we've made one innovation. Prior to this biennium, the vehicles had to physically be transferred to the state, and the state disposed of all the vehicles, whether funded with state funds or federal funds, through state surplus. So we, in some cases where the vehicle maybe had been in an accident and was a pile of junk, we'd still pay for DAS to go over there with a lowboy and haul it back, even though the recovery was less than that. But we were able to work with DAS and the Department of Justice and get clarification. And now if a vehicle is funded with federal funds, when that vehicle reaches the end of its useful life, and my vehicle program manager tracks this, when it reaches the end of its useful life, we sign off the title and release it. They can dispose of it as they see fit. They want to transfer it to a local family with a disabled son, and they can do that under their disposal property. That's okay. We're not involved. But unfortunately, we've been advised by council that where there is a state interest, where the vehicle was funded with state funds, we must retain that interest until the vehicle is ultimately disposed of. And now DAS, at least we've saved the low boys. We don't send them out any longer. DAS disposes of them on eBay.
Decision as to who gets the money. Sometimes it's state, sometimes it's local. If that entity decides that the folks who are providing the service are no longer the ones that are going to receive that money, therefore there's no service left from that entity, you can step in and take those vehicles and move them to whoever the new entity might be.
Chair George, Senator George, yes, as long as we have a security interest.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's your average vehicle life before you consider the end of its life cycle?
Chair George, Senator Morris, there are really two answers to that. There's a federal standard that the useful life table is based, or that our fair or better table is based on, that for normal vans, minivans, and up to one ton 15 passenger vans, the useful life standard for the federal government is 4 years or 100,000 miles. For larger vehicles, it's more years and more miles, up to full-size buses, which are 12 years and, I believe, 600,000 miles. As a practical matter, with good maintenance, these vehicles last longer than that. So many agencies, particularly the smaller agencies, will run vehicles for more than the 4 or 6 or 8 years that is stipulated as an average standard by the Federal Transit Administration.
Let me solve the problem real quick. I think since we went up, we're ready to get enough. Okay, so we're going to we'll watch turn. Excuse me, Senator Morris. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
We had folks here from Washington County. We wanted to make sure they weren't required to drive back.
Let me get to the main issue. Okay. Again, I can't let this issue go, the discrepancy between what LFO has and what the company books have, coupled with the fact that this agency started an audit in June 19 of 2000, characterized as a high-risk program in that it has a high percentage of that funds transferred. And that audit has yet to be completed. And I guess my request to the chairman would be to have an explanation of the discrepancy in the accounting, to have that presented to us in writing, and to have some understanding of why that audit hasn't been done, and if that, in fact, it has been, it just hasn't been printed. We should, I think, have the benefit of that audit. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we got another question?
Yeah, just one last question, and I promise to stay quiet. Are we maximizing the amount of dollars the state can generate from the non-urbanized area formula assistance program? Have we maximized our leverage on that, or are we leaving money on the table?
Chair George, Representative Smith, maximize. We draw down every penny that is appropriated to the state of Oregon for the non-urban areas.
Is that how that works? It's a direct appropriation to the state. It's not a...
Chair George, Representative Smith, yes, it is direct appropriation. We could leverage it by requiring the locals to provide more match, but that's often difficult.
I guess
we also want to speed up turning those grants into actually vehicles serving people. We could maximize by making that process happen faster, and we work in that area. But we're drawing every dollar that we can get our hands on.
Just so I'm clear, so the appropriation coming to the state is not based upon our amount of general fund contribution?
Chair George, Representative Smith, no.
Okay.
It's a formula driven by population and other factors.
Thank you.
briefly describe the special needs transportation area.
What page are you on, Martin?
Thank you. That would be on page 40. Most of our staffing and resources are focused in this area, meeting the needs of Oregon seniors and people with disabilities. For most of us, mobility is provided by driving ourselves in a car. There's nothing wrong with that. But for many elderly and disabled people, that isn't an option. Even if it still is an option legally, it is often better if the elderly with diminished driving skills drive less. For many, that option to secession, driving secession, results in isolation or loss of independence. That is very, very hard to accept and imposes great difficulty. I'm going through that with an 86-year-old father right now who feels about the keys to his Cadillac, and Charleston Heston feels about handguns. Yes. Performance. Prior to 1999, the number of rides division programs were able to deliver trended downward for a number of years, from 3.8 million in 97 to 3.7 in 98, a 2.6% drop, down to 3.5 million in 99, another 5.4% drop. In 1999, the legislature approved a $19 million funding package to improve transportation for the elderly and disabled. And you approved the package in 01, 03. That package consisted originally of $9 million in general fund and $10 million in flexible federal funds. These are what the Federal Highway Administration calls surface transportation, or STP funds, can be spent for any legal transportation use, bridges, highways, whatever. Transit's one of the eligible uses, and they've been dedicated to this purpose. Since then, rides increased to $4 million in 2000, a 14% increase, to $4.6 million in 2001, another 15% gain, and $5.5 million in 2002, nearly a 20% gain, for a 57% increase over 3 years. That's the good news. The good or bad news is that the population of the elderly is growing even faster. Senator Dukes asked a question yesterday that I will during Director Warner's agency overview. She noted that in that overview we targeted to deliver 7 rides per person by 2005, and noted quite accurately that that doesn't get people out of the house a lot. She followed her observation by asking what it would take to get that to move that number from 7 to 12 rides per person per year for the elderly and disabled. First, I'd like to confirm that Senator Duke's observation is correct. That isn't very many rides. The reality is that number is a very crude number derived from dividing the population, some 937,000 according to PSU in 2002, by the number of rides we're able to deliver. In reality, there's some elderly and disabled that need and get a lot of rides. There's some that need a lot of rides and get some. There's some that need rides and get none. And there are others that don't need rides. If you divide all of our costs, the $32 million or so proposed in the special needs area, the $11 million in the general public area, because a lot of that general public service benefits the elderly and disabled, and you divide that by the rides number, you get an average state investment per ride of about $3.96. Now, I hasten to add, that's not what a ride costs. There are local match required and all that, so that the average actual cost per ride is different. But our investment's about $3.96. So if we were going to move that the number of rides per person for the elderly and disabled from 7 to 12, that would be another $23 million rides at $3.96. That would be an investment of $93 million, or $50 million more than what we've requested in this budget. What does that tell us? Not a great deal, but we aren't meeting the need to do a lot more, cost more, and we didn't feel that these are the times to request more.
Senator Dukes?
Actually, it tells us quite a bit. Not much that you can do anything about. Oops, and the director's gone. But ODOT has an internal way of doing things when we go back to the federal government that says roads and bridges come first. Actually, roads come first. Never mind the bridges. And the briefing book that we give to members of Congress is a roads briefing book. After many battles, you are now allowed to make up a briefing book for the other pieces, the other modes. But it is the emphasis is never placed on it by those high-priced lobbyists that we have back in D.C. And the $53 million shouldn't be hard for us to get, considering we have those high-priced lobbyists, if we were ever to put a priority on it. But we do not. We drop off the modes briefing books. We emphasize the roads briefing books. So there is, I mean, it does tell us a lot. It tells us where our priorities are.
In the same vein, while we're talking about priorities, we're going to be revoting in the House. We'll be revoting either today or tomorrow on reinstating the renewing the 10-cent a pack cigarette tax. I attempted on this side to add 2 cents on top of that for counties, cities, and special need transportation, and was unsuccessful. But certainly on the Senate side, I would hope you'd revisit that concept, because that would produce a little bit of seed money in terms of us being able to meet, let the local communities either have match or have operating funds, and especially in light of the special session 6 actions that were taken, this might be a way to make those entities whole. But again, it's a question of establishing priorities. Is this a real important priority? Should be for the federal government. It also can be a priority we can do a little more for at the state level also.
Thank you. Moving on to it. And the other outcome that we expect to see in the special needs area is in continued improvement in the numbers and condition of the fleet of vehicles that we grant finance that are serving the elderly and disabled. This fleet has grown from some 404 vans and buses in 98, of which 274, 68%, were in fair or better condition, to a 683 vehicle fleet today, of which 83% are in fair or better condition, meeting our goal. The last performance measurement in this area, it relates to customer service. Page 50 includes a table relating to that. Probably what this shows, and I have to thank the legislation for pushing the area of performance measurement. We've always thought customer service was important, and when I talked to my staff, I said, heck yes, we process payments quickly. But it wasn't until we actually measured it that it really improved. I mean, the old adage about you value what you count. And when we started counting how many days it sat on somebody's desk, it sat there less. We set a goal to get payment requests processed 85% of them within 30 days, 100% within 60 days. It took us 5 quarters to exceed that goal, and we hope to be there for the 0305 biennium. In sense of volume, we process on average about 100 payments a quarter. At any given time, we've got 200 to 300 active grants that we're managing. We talked a bit about general public transportation. It's service for anyone who wants to ride. We only invest federal funds in this area, and then only to cities of 50,000 or less. We've been able to achieve the number of those cities providing bus service from 29 to 40. 29 in 1999 to 40 today. Examples of the communities we assist include Chair George mentioned Yamhill County, where he's working with a couple of not-for-profits, YCAP and the Chehalem Senior Center. These are general public providers in that county. Corvallis was one of our largest providers. They graduated to the small urban to get the money direct. But other cities, we've got Sunset Empire in Clatsop County, Ride Connection in rural Washington County, Woodburn, Albany, Lebanon, Sweet Home, The Oregon Housing and Community Services in the Marion and Polk County areas, the Warm Springs Tribe, Community Connection in Northeast Oregon, Pendleton, Milton Free Water, many small communities use this service. Our most important metric there is rides. Small cities have increased the number of rides some 75% from 1.3 million in 1999 to 2.3 million in 2001. Comparing this to the national picture, since 1990, small city and rural rides have increased 32%, while they have increased 60% in Oregon. For the 0305 biennium, our major outcome that we seek to achieve is to preserve service in about the 40 small cities we can currently serve and sustain ridership increases by increasing efficiency in the face of rising fuel and insurance costs. Our customer service goal is important here as well.
Martin, I want to get through this thing. So we have all the questions asked. We're going to run out of time, but we do need to get to Tom Bryan from Washington County. Okay. What would be your suggestion for us right now? I mean, can you come back?
I certainly may.
We're getting behind. We haven't even gotten the rail yet today.
I can cut back.
We'll cut back or come back.
What is the chair's pleasure? I have other stories I would like to share, but I would
come in for Senator Morris.
Yes,
anyway.
That's a good idea. Yes, correct. Okay.
Well, why don't I come back with the answer for the senator?
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Great. Appreciate it. We didn't get to the other questions that needed to be answered also.
Can I throw one up? And he can,
yes.
You mentioned performance measures, and I looked, and maybe it's just me, but all I found in the book was what the performance measures were. I didn't see anything that said, you know, This is what the outcome was of those performance measures, and this is what our goals are on those for the future. So.
Just a quick question, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in knowing how we document our collateral positions on the vehicles and knowing if we require and keep record of the insurance on the vehicles, particularly as it relates to nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. They can.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, at this time I'm going to invite Tom Bryan, Washington County Commissioner and Chair, and to come on up and talk about the commuter rail. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Bryan. I'm chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. Thank you very much for the time this morning, and my apologies to anyone else if I feel like I'm bumping somebody. So I feel a small amount of guilt about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a real pleasure to be with you today, and I wanted to I know your time is limited, so I will hit the highlights. This is in regard to House Bill 5056, an item therein that would extend the bond issuance dates for the commuter rail project that had been approved in the 2001 legislative session. I know this is not a substantive hearing on the commuter rail, but I want to give you the highlights to the committee just to kind of refresh on the project, and we'd be happy to get into any of the substantive issues that you wish, or separately at another time. We've handed out a map just to kind of help you conceptualize the project. It's 14.7 miles. We're essentially using, reusing, recycling existing freight track that has been actively used for decades in cooperation with the existing user, the P&W Railroad. And we have agreements with them for access and use, and the upgrade will actually facilitate faster movement of freight, and we will be using it strictly 3.5 hours during peak each morning and evening. It's 14.7 miles, as I said, shared track. We have contracts in place already with Portland and Western, Union Pacific, ODOT, and TriMet. And it's been a very broadly supported project in the region and among both our legislative delegation and our federal delegation. So the key point I'll get to, and then we can backtrack as the chair wishes, the 2001 legislature anticipated a certain bond sale sequence of totaling $35 million, and it was anticipated, it's required that the full funding grant agreement from the federal government be received prior to issuance of bonds. So we have to have the federal money in hand prior to spending any of the state money. For a variety of reasons, that's been being delayed. We had hoped to get our final design approval in the fall, last fall, and our full funding grant agreement this spring. And that's basically pushed back about 6 months, for a variety of reasons. Through the new administration, there's always a certain amount of reshuffling that goes on. You know, the entire federal budget was delayed last fall to the final resolution just about 30 days ago. And of course, there's a number of enormous issues on the federal plate. So we're still very optimistic that within 60 days we'll have our final design approval. We're already going through final design, but you cannot proceed past 40% without federal approval. We expect that in the next 60 days, and we are hopeful of our full funding grant agreement by this fall.
Let me interrupt you.
Yes, sir.
Do you have the other piece that was brought to my office, which two-sided, describing the trains, the route, the schedules, and stuff like that? That's it right there.
Yes.
Do you have any extra copies of that?
Dennis?
Okay.
Do you have how many copies of that? I have one I've marked just a little bit, Mr. Chairman, which you're welcome to have.
Well, no, it's okay. I was hoping you had enough for everyone.
We have.
Okay.
There you go. We do.
It's actually easier to read these things when they're in color.
Yeah. Yes, we do. The map depicts the 14.7-mile run from Wilsonville to Beaverton at its intersection with light rail. And you'll notice it stops, it's a limited stop, five total stops. It averages 37 miles per hour with those stops included, with peak travel speed of 60 miles an hour. So it's faster than the conventional light rail. It moves from Wilsonville to Beaverton with those stops in about 26 minutes compared to automobile traffic of ranging from 40 to 55 minutes, depending on how lucky you are, I guess, on a given date. And so it's very popularly supported, and people are looking forward to it. We've had a number of demonstration rides through assistance of ODOT and Pacific and Western, just to get people on it, even though we were using the old cars, old freight cars and things, old passenger cars. Now, it's been a lot of fun, and people are pretty excited about it. The 2001 session requires that the full funding grant agreement be received prior to issuance of bonds. And because now that appears to fall outside of, past this June 30th, we're now asking, and we're supportive of the extension to, let me just reference that. I think it's also in the handout. Pardon me for fumbling around on this. There we go. That the $20 million issuance be issued by June 30th, 2004, and the $15 million by June 30th of 2005, on or before. This allows us to comply with the federal, with the legislature's requirement of 2001, and does save interest earnings during that period.
Good question, Representative Smith.
Chair George. What's the additional savings or expense of the extension? Has the math been calculated on what it's going to cost?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, we're in process on that. I hate to quote numbers I've heard verbally, and I don't know if staff, Ms. Jordan, has additional information on that. I've seen numbers that it would save about $2.8 million in interest. But that is, I would, again, caution all of us till we get the number from the Treasurer's office.
But the feeling is, Chair George, that it is a savings.
It's the other side of that is, what does it cost if interest rate goes up in the 1 year? And so that's pretty speculative, although when the checking we have done is given the whole circumstances we find ourselves in nationally and so forth, that any increase in interest would be pretty minimal over the next 12 months.
Just one last quick, thank you, Chair. Can you remind this body, was the project to be self-sustaining, and is the project going to service the debt, or was the state servicing the debt?
Well, the total project cost, capital cost, is $123.5 million. This sheet that was just handed out shows where that comes from. 50% federal, $61.75 million. Locally, Washington County, in cooperation with its cities, have committed $16.5 million of capital. The 01 legislature committed $35 million of bond proceeds.
So just right there's my question.
Right.
So the state will be servicing the debt on the state lottery bonds?
Out of lottery.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in order to make this thing work, I understand, now this is just hearsay, that the 4650 number of trips that we're supposed to be doing by 2020, is that, the feds basically looked at that and said it's not adequate. Is that correct? And somebody's adjusted the numbers up?
What has happened is the Federal Transit Administration has a new formula called the T-sub formula, and they now require all the projects nationally to take their numbers and run them through the new formula. So that was one of the reasons for the delay, is they said, okay, we see those numbers, but we now want them under through our new system, through our new sieve. So we have been working with FTA and Metro doing that. So whatever they come out is whatever they come out. However, the preliminary information is that it is looking like mid-5,000s. It's actually looking to be even more favorable. But until... we're taking a very conservative approach on those, so we're still using our 4650 until those numbers are examined, re-examined, and until the federal government has an opportunity to go through them. But I would be willing to wager some small amount that they'll actually be up. And they're up because we are applying the federal government's formula, which is viewed as more restrictive. In other words, the administration is, and Jenna Dorn, who's the administrator of FTA, was just out last month, taking a very hard look at making these projects really make sense with the federal dollar. They're being much more stringent in their review of all the projects across the country so that they can speak about these projects and their benefit, firmly with a straight face.
Numbers.
Yeah.
Right.
And so they came out with this more restrictive formula, which, of course, worried us. They're going, oh, geez, now what? But we're very glad, because we were so conservative in our earlier estimates, that it'll be the same or larger number.
What worries me, and I went back and looked it up because I keep a file on this stuff from about 4 years ago when they were considering the rail, using the P&W rail to go out from basically Milwaukee to McMinnville, and they were forecasting at that time $112 million to do that. But the interesting thing was is that they were at that time saying by 2020, or right around 2020, they would only be 1,500 estimated trips. How do you really believe we're going to get to 4,600 or 5,000 or more rides? And what is the capacity of these trains?
Right. Okay. I'm not the expert, but I believe the experts. I mean, they've taken a lot of effort and been subjected to a lot of scrutiny on these projections. One of the reasons the ridership would be different between Wilsonville and Beaverton compared to Milwaukee to, say, Newburgh, is the density, the whole urban growth boundary restrictions. We've got five town centers and regional town centers on the route that require a lot of densification. The federal government, by the way, is looking at that very closely, because this is the first suburban-to-suburban commuter rail in the nation. And so a lot of their staff starts, well, these things can't work if you don't go downtown. And we're saying, well, not all roads lead to downtown Portland. We believe that our business and industry, residential densities make this thing operate as though it was going downtown. And because it's connecting to the light rail system, so you can live in Wilsonville, Tualatin, Tigard, take it to the light rail and go out to the airport, and with one change. This has a lot of positive features to it, and I think the numbers will be there, and that's my personal opinion.
This is a single track, right, with some spurs to pull off.
Yes, we're adding several turnouts.
How do you cycle enough runs? Now, you're talking about three. Are you talking about 3.5 hours total, or 3.5 hours in the morning and 3.5 hours in the evening?
3.5 hours in the morning, 3.5 hours in the evening.
Okay.
Now, they run on half-hour headways, which means there'll be a train passing every each stop every 15 minutes because one's going, one's coming. We're adding turnouts. This is all, you know, being engineered. And, of course, Federal Railroad Administration and Federal Transit Administration require extreme attention to safety, as they should. And so the cars will travel during that 3.5 hours. Freight will not be using those 3.5 hours. It runs about 32 trains during that time.
Do you believe you're going to get the waivers? Because if you notice where it says vehicles on this side of the page,
right.
It says that currently manufacturers don't build vehicles that meet the federal standards.
Right.
Are we going to be able to get a waiver?
Well, actually, it's because
of the fact that the freight's not on the rail?
Right. It's a great question, Mr. Chairman. Originally, we thought we'd have to get a waiver. However, this actually is a little bit behind the times in their reference. The red-colored car there, which is made by Colorado Rail Company out of Fort Lupton, is a totally new design. The challenge has been you want a car that will move like a commuter rail, start and stop easily, be attractive to the suburban user, and yet has to have that same 800,000-pound crush resistance that heavy rail does. And none exist in the world. However, there's a huge commuter rail market nationally. And so Colorado Rail Car, Bombardier out of Canada, have been working to develop one. So to cut right through it, the red car there, the diesel unit there, made by Colorado Rail Car, is operable. I have ridden it. They've made a national tour with it, and it has passed all federal standards. It has passed all federal standards. So they certainly are going to actively be submitting their bids, their proposals to us. TriMet is putting together the RFPs now. And there are two leading bidders right now. There may be others, but one is Colorado Rail Car, who has specifically designed this commuter rail car, and it's passed all federal standards. The second one is the Silver Car, which is made by Bombardier, and they're retrofitting it to acceptable federal standards. And they've got that commitment to us. And they're making, for example, I think about 1,000 of them for the Long Island Railroad. So we do have product available currently.
Okay, do you, again, because I was trying to make the math work on the route last night, actually over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
What do you expect the capacity? Because I've been told if you get beyond about 80%, you'll actually start discouraging ridership. Do you know what particularly the Colorado unit, how many people will carry it?
I believe it's 90, 95 per car.
Okay.
We can certainly firm that for you, that firm for you.
All right. And my question is that the number of people that I would expect to be moved in a given amount of time would require a substantial number of those units to move them.
But they'll move in two-unit pieces, so there'll be two cars at a time just to minimize any disruption in other traffic flows. But we were buying eight cars, so we'll have four sets. And with the turnouts, they'll be going back and forth so that even though each car has a 30-minute headway, there'll be pickup crossings every 15 minutes, if that makes sense. We totally support in the ODOT's budget extension of this bond. Not only does it help us comply with the intent of the 01 session, but we believe it will actually save money, and the Treasurer's Office is working on that for you to determine Representative Smith's question about when you delay, what happens if interest goes up? And you just have to guess if interest is going to go up very much in the next 12 months. And we're very happy to meet with any of you again as a committee or separately, privately, to provide any information that you need. We're very excited about the project, and really, you know, if you look at the cost is about $8.2 million per mile, And even though that's real money compared to limited access highways, it's probably 1/10 to 1/12 the cost of light rail. Not measuring light rail, but I mean, it's because we're reusing all of the right-of-way, all of the track, not disrupting business, and in fact enhancing some business operations. And the trackside economic development is a big feature. We are working with our cities planning trackside economic development. And as you probably are aware, the West Side Light Rail has spurred about $1 billion in construction along the light rail so far. Now, we won't be hitting $1 billion, but we have some major opportunities along that corridor.
Well, just a quick comment. I was, when this project was first being discussed, I was a little dubious of it just from the standpoint of who'd want to go from Wilsonville to Beaverton. On the other hand, my mom lives very close to Washington Square, so over the last few years I've had to drive 217 a lot, and of course the I-5 corridor. And I think the best friend this project has is the congestion that's there, which is just incredible. Just the combination of it's hard to expand that corridor, as well as the incredible growth that's occurred in it. And I've had to, you know, I was raised in Washington County, so I know the back roads, even though the back roads have all changed. But even trying to avoid 217, I've spent an hour trying to get from Tualatin into Tigard. And that's in the middle of the afternoon.
Right.
I mean, it's not just a rush hour thing. And when you look at the way that area has changed and evolved, I think this project is just incredibly needed, and it's got a real potential.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, nothing is going to fix the traffic congestion. Or, I mean, virtually, we need all of the above. We need more road and highways. We need more capacity. We need more buses. We need more rail. And one of the things this gets at is what we call circumferential movement rather than radial movement. In other words, Washington County now has more people coming into Washington County to work every day than leave. So that's changed. And movement from south to north, back and forth, other than 217, it's all neighborhoods and local arterials. So this will, you know, do its share. It will help. And it's certainly not going to solve Washington County's transportation challenges, but I'm hoping that if we do enough of the right things and keep at it, continually using every angle we can, you know, maybe it won't get much worse. And that's kind of not a very high-sounding goal, but that's reality.
Tom, there was a question that came up, and I actually talked with a representative about this, and that is the fact that it blocks the major commute, which is an east-west commute in the morning.
Right.
It blocks that, and it will be blocking it every about 15 to 17 minutes. Crossing guards are going to come down.
Right.
And now, is my understanding, is that just one way, or we have the trains coming back, so is it going to be half of that amount of
15
time?
15 minutes is the sum of the two.
The total together.
Right.
Okay, and that's good.
Well, that's a critical point, Mr. Chairman, and one that we've spent a lot of time with in the design stages. The environmental impact statement, all of that, and the alternatives have looked at that. There are two angles. You have the controlled crossings, the ones that have the lights now.
Right.
And the synchronization system that this has will be very elaborate for both safety reasons and traffic. So when a train is approaching an intersection, it moves those, it signals those lights.
Mm-hmm.
Those lights already have a red light on cycle.
Right.
And the passing through, especially if it's not near a train station, these are passing through somewhere between 30 and 60 miles an hour, and there's only two cars. So it's a very short period of time. And none of the stations are situated to ever stop and block an intersection. That's an absolute.
Concern. First of all, first blocking, but the other thing was, you know, untiming the whole system that is timed. You know, that we've done a good job of getting that up. But also the idea that there's so many crossings there that are not guarded.
Right.
And that was part of this cost going to be guarding. And my understanding is that you're acquiring literally the right-of-way, but not owning the dirt underneath. But in other words, you're taking ownership of the rail under this project.
Right. It's a combination of things. You know, I've learned that when you buy, when you talk about railroad, you have the dirt, the track, and the hardware, and then the use of
right.
it. Three different ownerships. Of this 14.7 miles, ODOT owns the substantial piece of it, something like 8 or 9 miles of it, I believe, and Claudia could correct me on that. But we're purchasing, the project is purchasing about five and a half miles of it from Union Pacific. And much to the federal government's, the agency's surprise, we actually have a deal already negotiated with them, which in what they considered record time for us was 3 years. No offense, Mr. Cutter. Is he still seated?
Yes. He's smiling.
But they were very cooperative to work with, but there's a lot of process to go through. So the track will be in public ownership for the commuter rail. Then P&W, however, has use rights that are extremely long. I think it's 30 or 40 years, and we have an agreement with them. And we'll be making millions of dollars of upgrades to the track, as well as the safety crossings and so forth. So they're actually quite pleased. It'll increase their freight capacity. We're feeling like it's a real win-win. I mean, we've worked well with, in fact, the operating manager for Portland and Weston has been on our steering committee from the beginning, comes to all of our events, and we've involved him in all phases of discussion and negotiation, as well as Genesee Wyoming, the owner of P&W out of Connecticut, and we've worked with them.
Well, we appreciate you being here today, and we're glad we got you in.
Right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman,
further
for
questions.
Doing that. I'd be happy to come back at your anytime you would wish.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're good. Right now going to, at the top of the gavel, close the public hearing and the invited testimony. And with the top of the gavel, we will be adjourned.
Just a reminder, we'll be in hearing room F tomorrow.